From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I remember that morning when I woke up and I had my dead son in my arms. I couldn't even open my eyes to see him, see the last of him, because my eyes were so swollen that I had to force them with my fingers.
20 years ago today, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from Union Carbide's pesticide factory in Bhopal, India. Over 7,000 people were killed. 15,000 more have died in the following years. More than 100,000 still suffer from the effects of being poisoned. To commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal chemical disaster, today we'll spend the hour talking about one of the worst industrial disasters of the 20th century. But first, we'll take a look at how the military distributed misinformation to the media as part of a campaign of psychological operations. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military has officially announced it's sending 12,000 more troops to Iraq to bring the total number of troops in Iraq to 150,000, the highest level since the U.S. occupation began more than a year and a half ago. The military claims the extra troops are needed only temporarily in the lead-up to the January elections. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, Agence France-Presse is reporting thousands of U.S. soldiers are preparing a major attack against Taliban fighters. The offensive is expected to begin within days of the December 7th inauguration of President Hamid Karzai. A new congressional report has found many students participating in federally funded abstinence-only programs have been taught misleading and inaccurate information about abortion, homosexuality, and AIDS. Students have been taught that abortion can lead to sterility and suicide, that half the gay male teenagers in the United States have tested positive for AIDS, and that touching a person's genitals can, quote, result in pregnancy. This according to a report in the Washington Post. The congressional report found that for the past 3 years, the Bush administration has been strongly promoting three abstinence programs even though they frequently relied on medically inaccurate and misleading information, often in direct contradiction to the findings of government scientists. The congressional report examined the 13 most widely used abstinence-only curricula, only two of the program deemed to be accurate. Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman of California said, quote, "Something is seriously wrong when federal tax dollars are used to mislead kids about basic health facts." In Ukraine, the nation appears to be heading toward holding a new election to resolve the political crisis that developed after last week's disputed presidential votes. Candidates Viktor Yanukovych and Viktor Yushchenko have agreed to seek a solution once the Supreme Court rules on electoral fraud allegations. Jailed Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti has announced he will run in the upcoming January 9th election to fill Yasser Arafat's post as head of the Palestinian Authority. Barghouti is currently serving five life sentences in an Israeli prison. The last-minute decision stunned many. Just 5 days ago, Barghouti had announced he would not run for office. Barghouti will face former Prime Minister and current PLO chair Mahmoud Abbas and several other candidates, including pro-democracy activist Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. The jailed Barghouti said his candidacy would be a gesture of loyalty to Arafat and to the, quote, martyrs, prisoners, and other victims, and to hold on to the principles of the right of return and the right of refugees. Meanwhile, the Palestinian group Hamas is encouraging its supporters to boycott the election. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh said it considered the election to be, quote, merely a tool to prop up the Palestinian Authority. Islamic Jihad also has called for a boycott. In China, the death toll from Sunday's coal mine explosion has reached 166, making it one of the country's worst mining accidents ever. On Wednesday, some 800 relatives and co-workers of the victims stormed a government office in protest. The families accused the mine managers of negligence and greed. They also charged the miners were forced to continue working even after dangerous gas levels were detected days before. Armed with search warrants, the FBI searched the Washington headquarters of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee as part of an ongoing spy investigation. AIPAC officials have been accused of illegally sharing classified government documents with the Israeli government concerning U.S. policy toward Iran. A grand jury also delivered subpoenas on Wednesday for four top officials of AIPAC. No criminal charges have been filed yet in the case. Harvard Law School has announced it will resume its policy barring the military from sending recruiting agents to campus. The move comes days after a federal court ruled that the government cannot threaten to cut funding to schools that bar military recruiters. Harvard Law School is banning the military because its Don't Ask, Don't Tell rule violates the school's non-discrimination policy. In Philadelphia, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union took over a military recruiting office on Tuesday, attempted to set up a homeless encampment there known as Bushville. The protest came as a part of a campaign called Homes for the Holidays, Operation Bring the Money Home. In Britain, the Daily Telegraph newspaper has been ordered to pay nearly $300,000 to the anti-war MP George Galloway. Galloway sued the paper for libel after it reported he'd received secret payments from Saddam Hussein through the Oil for Food program. Galloway said, quote, "This was done to me because I was a leader of the anti-war movement." He went on to say, quote, "The real enemies of our state are those who've led us into this disaster in Iraq and those in Parliament and the media who supported them." The city of Portland, Oregon, has agreed to pay out $300,000 to 12 anti-war protesters who claim the police used excessive force against them in a series of protests beginning August 2002 when President Bush visited the city. In two lawsuits, the protesters argued the city police violated their rights to free speech and free assembly by dousing them with pepper spray at close range and firing rubber sting balls into the crowd. CBS and NBC have rejected a new TV commercial from the United Church of Christ because it deems the ad too controversial. In the ad, the church announces it welcomes gays and lesbians, and it alluded to condemnation of gay relationships by other churches. A CBS spokesperson claimed the ad was rejected because the network has a policy of not accepting advocacy advertising. The ad shows a muscular bouncer working a rope line outside a nameless church, deciding who is eligible to enter and worship. When the bouncer sees two men holding hands, he says, quote, "No, step aside, please." Across the screen comes the message, "Jesus didn't turn people away. Neither do we." The final scene shows two women embracing.
To me, more precious love, the purest thing, more precious love, so good to me, more precious love, the purest thing. Was born in a small town called Pacoima, California, where them gangsters bang ghetto life, thugging on the corner, youngest child of six, when I came, pop split with mama, used to visit on weekends, till he moved to the north side of Cal, 14, he died, 15, my mom's died, alcoholic, diabetic forces,
Blackalicious here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military is reportedly distributing misinformation to the media as part of a campaign of PSYOPs, psychological operations, this according to a report in the Los Angeles countless times. Papers uncovered incidents where the military has sent spokespeople to major news networks to deliberately lie about military operations in Iraq in an effort to deceive the Iraqi resistance. In one case, on October 14th, a Marine spokesperson appeared on CNN from Fallujah and said troops crossed the line of departure. CNN was soon reporting the battle for Fallujah had begun. In fact, it would not begin for another 3 weeks. A senior Pentagon official told CNN that Gilbert's remarks were, quote, technically true but misleading. It was an attempt to get CNN, quote, to report something not true, the official said. The military claimed it wanted to see how Iraqi fighters responded to the so-called news report. Several top officials told the Los Angeles Times they see a danger of blurring what are supposed to be well-defined lines between the stated mission of military public affairs and psychological and information operations. One senior Pentagon official told the paper, quote, the movement of information has gone from the public affairs world to the psychological operations world. What's at stake is the credibility of people in uniform, he said. We're joined on the phone by Colonel Sam Gardner. He's a retired Air Force colonel. He's taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, Air War College, and Naval War College. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Your response to this latest report?
Well, it's actually more of the same. It's interesting to me that people would pick up on this right now because it was so pervasive before and during Gulf II. This is just a small incident compared to what we've seen before. The real distinction, however, is in the past, most of these falsehoods, psychological operations, strategic communications themes, came from civilians. This is one of the first times when a military officer has actually and visibly crossed the line. And that's a big deal because the military is the only profession I know where lying is a criminal offense. In the Uniform Code of Military Justice, it is a court-martial offense for an officer to tell a lie. And I, frankly, this lieutenant who talked to CNN is subjected to himself to potential court-martial.
Last night, watching Fox, the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich basically said, whatever it takes to protect our troops.
But, Amy, we're supposed to be protecting democracy. The troops have taken an oath to protect democracy. And if we destroy democracy to protect the troops, something's gone terribly wrong. I think I couldn't disagree more with Newt Gingrich. The other part of that, Amy, is that as a former officer, this just is sort of goes to my essence, and that's the notion that an officer's word is his bond, whether he is speaking to the troops, to other officers, or in public. When we cross the line, when you begin to not be able to trust the word of an officer, we have begun to destroy the military from within.
Can you explain this idea of PSYOPs, the psychological operations, how it's used abroad and what's happening now at home?
Well, what have Amy, this is, has a very long tradition in the U.S. military and in militaries of the world, which is the notion that you use bad information or distorted information to target the enemy. Up until probably about 15 years ago, that notion was meant that it would be done on the battlefield. There became a growing idea within the military of a thing called information warfare, which was the sort of the concept that you would bring it outside the battlefield. And what's happened, and this is what's so serious, is that it has now been taken into the public airways. And we can't tell whether or not we are getting the truth from the military or psychological operations. And I have to say, frankly, I think, and again, I would very strongly disagree with Newt Gingrich, because you don't have to. Let's say that this is a valid notion. We wanted the bad guys in Fallujah to think we were coming early. That doesn't have to to permeate and distort the worldwide media for that message to get across. That's the kind of thing that you deliver locally. They're not communicating with the world. If you want to do it by feigned attacks, if you want to do it by leaflets, that's fine. But don't put it on CNN for all of us to hear.
What do you think should happen right now about this information? I mean, the military, at least in this report, being quite clear about what they're doing, that psychological operations is their new approach here at home and abroad, or not their new approach, as you have pointed out in your own report on the analysis of stories that came out of Iraq from the military that were simply psyops, not true, going right to Jessica Lynch.
I think the U.S. military ought not to be allowed to tell other than truth to the media. The military has no business being in the strategic communications deception business. Let me just give you an example of what ought not to happen. There is, from the Special Operations Command in Florida, an ad on the web right now for PR firms to come and bid a proposal and, you know, to work, do government work so that they can do media operations that have a psychological dimension that, quote, and I'll quote the document, to be broadcast worldwide. Amy, the military ought not to do that. You know, this is the kind of thing that politicians do. And in fact, that was the way the administration controlled the message in the war, was to send politicians down to do it. But when the guys in uniform begin to tell untruths, we've got problems.
Colonel Sam Gardner, I want to thank you for being with us. Colonel Sam Gardner is a retired Air Force colonel. This
Thanks,
is
Amy.
Democracy Now! Thank you very much. As we turn now for the rest of the hour to this 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. On the night of December 2nd, 1984, the early morning hours of December 3rd, the city of Bhopal, India, tons of lethal gas leaked from a U.S. pesticide factory. Clouds of suffocating gases blanketed the city of 500,000 people. Residents awoke with throats burning, tears streaming. They began a desperate flight through the dark streets. The gases produced so much fluid in people's lungs, many drowned in their own body fluids. Many fell dead as they ran. No alarm ever sounded, a warning, no evacuation plan was prepared. 7,000 people lost their lives within days. 15,000 more died in the following years. Now 100,000 others still are suffering from chronic and debilitating illnesses, one of the worst industrial disasters of the 20th century. Today we're going to play an excerpt from a film just made that includes a look at Bhopal, and then we'll speak with people from Bhopal, India, to New Delhi, to right here in the United States about the effects. And we'll talk about corporate responsibility with the author of Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical and the Toxic Century. But first, we go to a clip of the film that looks at Bhopal and other areas. It's called Scared Sacred.
My husband used to work in Union Carbide, and he knew that there was something deadly going to happen one day. I remember the day before on the Sunday, we went very happily because all our family was together. We were all feasting, and we went in a happy way. Everyone was stopping us in their regard on Sunday night, and they kept telling us, don't go back. Stay behind, go tomorrow morning. But my husband had to go to Union Carbide for his work. When we came back from there, we went back to sleep. I put all the children to bed. I couldn't sleep somehow. I was very, very restless that night. I don't know what it was, but something just didn't let me sleep all night. In the middle of the night, we woke up choking. I started coughing, and my eyes started watering, and I heard voices outside the house. People were screaming, "Run, run for your life, there's a deadly gas." And we could not run away because all our children were very small. I remember that morning when I woke up and I had my dead son in my arms. I couldn't even open my eyes to see him, see the last of him, because my eyes were so swollen that I had to force them with my fingers. And I remember that there was a tree outside my house which had lovely fruit, and that whole tree had turned black the next morning.
In the train, and I went out of the train station, and there were all over people groaning in pain and people falling down and fainting, or hundreds and hundreds of people like this in pain. And there were some volunteers who were giving some medicine, some fruit, some water. So I came out of the station and I joined these volunteers. After working for a week in trying to provide relief, what was very clear was it was too big. There were too many people crying out for medical relief and care, and it was impossible for private bodies or non-governmental bodies to do this. And what was very clear was that by that time it was becoming clear that the government would not help people on its own unless it was pressured into doing this. And the third thing that was very clear was that the Indian government and the multinational Indian Carbide were together.
After the disaster, Union Carbide focused its resources on evading responsibility. When doctors asked for the ingredients of the pesticide so they could find a way to treat the wounded, the company said it was a trade secret. And even as the graveyards and crematoriums were filling with bodies, they insisted there was nothing more than a potent tear gas. A phase the survivors call re-victimization began.
I'm sure my husband watches me from somewhere, and his soul must be in pain. There's not a day that goes by when I don't think about the people who I've lost. This is my youngest. And every time I look at him and I feel like maybe there is hope, maybe the world isn't that bad. But then my memory keeps going back to the people I've lost in this world.
The words of people who survived the Bhopal disaster 20 years ago, remembering from Scared Sacred by Velcro Ripper, a new film that is out. When we come back, we'll continue our discussions on this 20th anniversary. Stay with us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On this 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster, one of the worst industrial disasters of the 20th century, we look at what took place in Bhopal. The factory that caused the disaster was owned by a U.S. company called Union Carbide. In 1987, the Bhopal District Court charged Union Carbide and its officials, including its CEO, Warren Anderson, with culpable homicide, grievous assault, and other serious offenses. Union Carbide and its officials have repeatedly ignored the court's summons. In 1989, Union Carbide and the Indian government arrived at a negotiated settlement of $470 million for all gas-related injuries. Today, on the 20th anniversary of the tragedy, we are looking at Bhopal. A large portion of the funds have been held by the Indian government. We turn first to Satyanath Sarangi of the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal, joining us from Bhopal. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, everybody. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Sati. Can you start off by talking about the situation today in Bhopal?
In many ways, you could say that the situation today in Bhopal is worse than it was 20 years back on the morning of 3rd December, because about 150,000 people are still chronically ill, and still there is no treatment known because Union Carbide and now Dow Chemical is still withholding information, medical information. So there is no treatment protocol. And then there are new diseases like cancers and tuberculosis that people are getting. We know that the next generation is affected, and this study was published in the Journal of American Medical Association, which shows that the children born to exposed parents are shorter, thinner, lighter, and they have smaller heads. And also the girls born to exposed parents have a range of menstrual disorders, painful menstruation, irregular cycles. And on top of that, you have the health problems of 20,000 people living next to the factory who are drinking groundwater through hand pumps that are contaminated with cancer-causing and toxic chemicals in heavy concentrations.
I wanted to ask you about the settlement with Union Carbide, and I wanted you to respond to a Union Carbide statement. We called Union Carbide and Dow Chemical to ask for a response. They wouldn't join us on the show, but they did send us an audio clip of Union Carbide spokesman Tom Sprick. This is what he had to say.
We are gratified to learn that this past July, the Indian Supreme Court ordered the government of India to release the remaining funds in the settlement, estimated to be in the neighborhood of $325 million. We feel that money will go a long way towards helping the victims and their families.
Your response to that?
Sati Sarangi. I'm sorry, Amy. I could not understand it clearly.
He basically said Union Carbide has said that a large portion of the funds that they negotiated a settlement with the Indian government have been held, and they're now gratified to hear that those funds are being released.
That is, what was left behind, the balance of the settlement fund was basically the interest it had earned, and because of the valuation, because of the change of the dollar value. So that is now getting distributed. But the point remains that more than 95% of the people will still get something like $1,000 maximum for injuries that are going to last till a lifetime, till their death.
What are you demanding? What are you demanding?
Union Carbide should,
go ahead. What were you saying?
No, what I was saying was Union Carbide should know that the settlement would not have been accepted in any U.S. court because not a single victim was consulted when a settlement was made secretly between the government of India and Union Carbide. It was totally spelled out by the government and most possibly through pressure brought upon by the United States government, which is once again being exposed as being supporting Union Carbide and Warren Anderson.
We're going to turn now to Jack Doyle. He is author of the book Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical and the Toxic Century. Jack Doyle, can you talk about Union Carbide and its relationship with Dow Chemical?
Well, yes. Dow initially made the announcement in 1999 that it was acquiring Union Carbide. And, you know, there were questions at the time. I mean, some analysts were wondering why Dow Chemical would make an acquisition of a company not only that had this unsettled Bhopal liability still hanging over it, but also had asbestos liability questions. And Dow apparently was confident that it could acquire this company and resolve these issues. And as it continues to this day to sidestep some of these key questions about Bhopal and leading us to where we are today. But, I mean, from an economic standpoint, Dow looked at Union Carbide and saw that it had assets in the Middle East in terms of some energy and petrochemical resources that it felt outweighed some of the liability that that Bhopal and the asbestos question offered. So it's kind of amazing to reflect on how a corporation like Dow makes a decision like this from a liability standpoint. They're confident. I mean, when you look at Dow, as I have, over a 70, 80-year period, and you see this continued business-like approach in terms of how it looks at assets and its business plan, it just marches forward and uses the best lawyers and the best lobbyists that money can buy to get what it wants.
We're also joined on the phone by Ryan Bodagni. He is coordinator of Students for Bhopal, which is organizing events at colleges around the world. Can you talk about how you got involved with this issue, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that the process by which I got involved is very similar to that by which other students are getting involved. And that's very simply that I learned the truth about what had happened in Bhopal. You know, there are many students that are my age that are simply unfamiliar with the disaster. They've never heard of it before, or they think that it's over because it happened, you know, when we were very young. However, when students find out that this is the world's worst industrial disaster, that the survivors have never had justice, that people are still being contaminated today, they're outraged, just like any human being would be. And so now, just like they did in the 1970s, they're demanding that Dow Chemical end its association with death and destruction around the world. And so what we have this year is there's about 60 students at about 60 colleges and universities and high schools around the world that are taking action. They're organizing vigils, they're organizing protests, and they're organizing demonstrations. And in those cases where their institutions, their educational institutions, are associated with Dow Chemical, they're demanding, just like they did during the Vietnam War, that those associations end.
Can you talk about what different schools are doing today and tomorrow and this weekend?
Yeah, there's as you can imagine, with 60 schools, there's quite a variety of different events that are planned. There are an awful lot of vigils to commemorate, you know, the suffering of the people of Bhopal and those who have died. There are recreations of the disaster. There are movie screenings, there are performances, there are demonstrations and protests outside of, you know, Dow facilities and outside the homes of Dow board members. So there's quite a variety of events. It's limited only really by the creativity of the students who are involved.
How do people find out about these events?
Well, you can find out about the events that are planned by students around the world by visiting studentsforbhopal.org. And you can find out about the international events that are planned, which are right now scheduled to take place in, I think, over 20 countries in 300 different locations around the world by visiting bhopal.net.
I want to turn to Jack Doyle, author of Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical and Toxic Century. Your book has just come out. You talk about the history of Dow Chemical. Can you talk about when it acquired Union Carbide?
The announcement was made in 1999 when Dow acquired Carbide. But it had to run through the Securities and Exchange Commission review, the Federal Trade Commission. And after it was approved, it was finally fully integrated into the company in 2001. And it was, you know, it was a sizable acquisition. It put Dow at the top of the list of chemical. Dow is now the largest chemical company in the world, and that essentially for the last 4 or 5 years running, it dominated the global chemical company list. It is simply the largest chemical company out there today, and because primarily of the acquisition of Union Carbide.
On the line with us also is Vijay Nagaraj, a consultant with Amnesty International, author of a new report out called Clouds of Injustice, Bhopal Disaster, 20 Years On. Can you talk about the findings of your report and why you and Amnesty decided to take on this project?
Yeah, hi. I think the most important finding of the report is nothing new. It's what everybody knows, that 20 years later, after 20,000 deaths and more than 540,000 people being injured and more than 150,000 people being chronically ill, nobody has been held responsible for what happened. And I think that's the biggest concern of this report. The other big concern that the report deals with, of course, is that multinational corporations today are playing an increasing role in the everyday lives of people. And however, there is no regulatory framework that covers and regulates their activities to ensure that they don't result in human rights violations. As far as Bhopal is concerned, quite clearly, the immediate crisis is firstly of the survivors who are suffering, their immediate need for comprehensive medical, economic, and social rehabilitation, the immediate need for just compensation for the survivors, and of course, in terms of the company, the fact that the criminal case is still continuing in Bhopal, and that Union Carbide Corporation, now owned by Dow Chemicals, has to face trial for what happened in 1984. And the other big issue that is still open is that of the contamination, the continuing pollution of groundwater and soil because of the poisons that are leaching from the abandoned factory site. So there are a whole set of issues around Bhopal, and a lot of them, I think, tend to be at the point where hazardous technology, the power of multinational capital, and state reluctance meet to turn what was really industrial callousness into a human rights disaster.
We're going to break, and then we're going to come back with this discussion and also hear more from the audio clips that were sent by Dow Chemical. We're sorry they wouldn't participate in the conversation, but they did send some clips of their spokesperson. We'll hear about what they have to say about safety, and we'll continue this discussion of Bhopal, Union Carbide, and now Dow Chemical. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. In the early morning hours of December 3rd, late in the night of December 2nd, the Bhopal pesticide plant of Union Carbide leaked gas. In the ensuing days, 7,000 people were killed. Years following, another 15,000 people died. Now 100,000 people still suffer debilitating and chronic illnesses. It was considered one of the worst industrial disasters in the 20th century. As we hear now from Tom Sprick, Union Carbide spokesperson, an audio clip that was sent to us by the company.
The 20th anniversary of Bhopal continues to evoke strong emotions around the world, and rightly so. None of us at Union Carbide, including myself, will ever forget the scope of this tragedy. Union Carbide and the chemical industry as a whole has learned a great many things from this tragedy, such as the importance of continuing to improve community awareness, emergency response, and process safety standards.
That is Tom Sprick of Union Carbide. And I'm wondering, Vijay Nagarash, author of the Amnesty Report, Clouds of Injustice, Bhopal Disaster 20 Years On, if you can respond to that.
Well, I think Union Carbide's sympathy for the victims of Bhopal sounds rather shallow to me, for the simple fact that it's been 20 years since the gas leak occurred. And it's time to remind the world that it was not just 25 tons of deadly methyl isocyanate that leaked that night, but there were also 11 tons of reaction products. And these reaction products could include hydrogen cyanide, nitrous oxide, carbon monoxide. And the fact that there were these 11 tons of reaction products is stated in Union Carbide's own investigation report. But till date, 20 years later, despite all the talk of sympathy for the victims of Bhopal, UCC has not named what those reaction products were. I think UCC has to, and Dow Chemicals, really have to walk the talk. And if they're really so concerned about the victims of Bhopal, forget about everything else. They should just start by telling us what was the composition of those reaction products, what is the toxicology of those products, what is the research they have at MIT and its impacts, why haven't they made it public? I mean, it's all very well to say that it evokes strong emotions and they remember it and so on and so forth, but quite obviously they've forgotten the victims of Bhopal. They don't remember the fact, perhaps, that it cost them just 48 cents a share.
We're talking to the author of an Amnesty report, Vijay Nagarash, who is in New Delhi, India. Can you go on from that issue of responsibility and talk about, at this point, what needs to be done?
Well, I think there are clearly, as far as Dow and Union Carbide are concerned, like I said, the first thing that needs to be done is for them to give us information. What were the gases that leaked that night? What is their toxicology and so on and so forth? The second important thing is for them to clean up the plant site. Let's remember that the pollution of groundwater and soil around the plant began way before the gas leak. It began in the early 70s because of poor waste disposal practice. And it has continued since then, poisoning the groundwater to more of tons of people in the community. So that the plant site needs to be cleaned up. And fourthly, and thirdly, they have to cooperate with efforts that are being made to find out exactly how to detoxify the victims of Bhopal. But most importantly, they have to appear in court to face trial. We must remember that no court in the world, United States or in India, has declared that Union Carbide is not liable. That matter is yet to be decided. The criminal trial is ongoing in Bhopal, and Union Carbide and Dow, by virtue of being its owner, has the responsibility to ensure that Carbide appears before court and faces trial. And as far as the victims are concerned, the government of India and the government of Madhya Pradesh obviously have an obligation to ensure that that justice is done, that they do everything possible to secure justice for the victims, and including and especially ensuring comprehensive medical, economic, and social rehabilitation for the victims. And I think Amnesty International in the report also calls on the international community, including the government of the United States, to cooperate with the efforts of the government of India to ensure that the victims get justice. as well as to the United Nations to ensure that not just provide technical assistance to the victims of Bhopal, but also to ensure that there is the development of a regulatory framework to ensure that there are no more Bhopals ever again.
Let me play another comment of the Union Carbide spokesperson. Of course, the way they are doing it by sending clips is they don't respond directly to any questions. They put out what they want to put out. So that's why we're sorry they can't be a part of the discussion. But this is Union Carbide spokesperson Tom Sprick on the cause of the Bhopal disaster.
There is no question in the mind of Union Carbide that a disgruntled employee who introduced an unusually large amount of water into the tank of methyl isocyanate was responsible for causing the runaway reaction. An exhaustive study proved that, and our study was in turn substantiated by an independent study conducted by A.D. Little Company.
Vijay Nagaraj of Amnesty International, is this what you found?
Well, I think it's important to recollect that what Carbide refers to as an independent study by Arthur D. Little was a study that was paid for by Union Carbide. And they were the ones who first floated, Ashok Kalelkar, one of the people associated with the ADL, first floated the sabotage theory. And in fact, even though Carbide claimed that they knew who the employee was, they have never named the employee. And in any case, the sabotage theory is probably not going to stand in court, but that's besides the point. The fact of the matter is that as the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research in India, India's premier scientific body, their study showed, and Carbide's own studies acknowledged, the fact is that the methyl isocyanate that leaked that night was manufactured more than 2 months ago. I think it doesn't require extraordinary amounts of intelligence to understand that if you store hazardous material in large quantities for long periods of time, you're inviting trouble. And that's exactly what Union Carbide did in Bhopal. The plant was designed by Union Carbide, and it was designed in such a way as to store large quantities of hazardous material, such as MIC, for long periods of time. And that's an invitation for trouble. Not to mention the fact that crucial safety systems failed. In violation of Union Carbide's own safety regulations, the MIC that leaked had not been refrigerated. The refrigeration unit had been turned off for a period of time before that. It was not kept under liquid nitrogen pressure, as Union Carbide's own safety manuals say that MIC should be stored. The vent gas scrubber, which is an emergency mechanism to burn off MIC that could possibly leak, was not working that night. It was out of service. And what is crucially important is the fact that we have the report discusses how Union Carbide's safety, levels of safety between in Bhopal and in West Virginia, in Institute in West Virginia, were vastly different. The Bhopal plant was not equipped with the same degree of safety mechanisms. And Union Carbide knew in September 1984 there was an operational safety survey conducted of the Institute plant. And at the Institute plant, they were warned that there was a possibility that a runaway reaction could occur in one of the external tanks, which could lead to a leak. And that's exactly what happened in Bhopal. But we don't have any evidence in our position to the effect that UCC actually warned the Bhopal plant people about or shared this information with them. So there's overwhelming evidence to show that Union Carbide knew that there were problems with safety in the plant. They had done safety surveys of the plant, and there were problems. It was well known in the public. It was in the public domain, and the crucial safety systems failed that night. They stored large quantities of hazardous material for long periods of time under conditions which were inappropriate, which were in violation of their own safety regulations. And, what do you expect?
Again, we're talking to Vijay Nagaraj, who's done a comprehensive report for Amnesty International called Clouds of Injustice, Bhopal Disaster 20 Years On. What happens to people who continue to organize 20 years later? You have a segment in one of your chapters called Repression of Activists.
Well, I think we have seen in the past there have been instances where where people who have been working with the victims have had to face the ire of state authorities. And this has happened particularly in the context of mass large organized protests faced by victims on various aspects of the struggle. And I think this is only part of a larger set of violations that the survivors and victims have been subjected to, where they have been treated less like victims and more like more like people who are demanding certain special privileges. It's very important to remember that what happened to the victims of Bhopal would have gone by now, 20 years later, largely unnoticed and forgotten if it wasn't for the fact that they have struggled and organized so hard over the last 20 years, and very often against all odds, and very often also and have also had to face the occasional acts of repression. So I do think the fact that we are talking about Bhopal today, after 20 years, to this extent, we owe that to the struggle of the people of Bhopal.
I want to go now to Jack Doyle, author of Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical and the Toxic Century. The crisis of Bhopal was one issue that Union Carbide and then Dow Chemical acquiring it has to deal with. What about Dow's history and other major disasters like Agent Orange?
Yeah, Amy, if I could come back to that in a minute, I just wanted to react to one thing that Tom Spreck said in his taped message, if that would be okay. He alluded to the fact that Union Carbide has learned lessons about chemical plant safety since Bhopal. And while that's true, I mean, there have been laws passed. I mean, there's been a lot of requirement for posting releases of toxic materials, and there's a right-to-know statute that was passed in the wake of Bhopal, and a lot about chemical plant safety has been improved since Bhopal here in the States. But it's interesting that Union Carbide, the parent corporation now, Dow Chemical, just in most recently, there was in the wake of 9/11, there's been chemical safety and security measures advanced in Congress. And in 2002, Senator Corzine had legislation for chemical plant safety and security called the Chemical Security Act of 2001. And in July 2002, that was passed out unanimously out of committee, but it was blocked by 30 chemical and oil companies, Dow among them. And this legislation had requirements for EPA to oversee security of the facility and to require inherently safer technologies in the plants that would prevent accidents from occurring in the first place. So here you have Dow and you know, Union Carbide spokesman today saying that they've learned lessons from Bhopal, but yet, with the other hand, they're in Congress lobbying to actually prevent improved chemical plant security by lobbying against these laws and preventing better provisions from getting into law. But the book that I've done on Dow, Trespass Against Us, this book tries to get at a larger issue here of chemical body burden, the fact that today places like the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta are finding toxic substances in the blood and body tissue of most Americans. So far, 500 substances have been detected in human blood and body tissue.
Jack Doyle, Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical and the Toxic Century is his book. I wanted to go back to Vijay Nagarajan, New Delhi, who is the amnesty consultant who did Clouds of Injustice. Warren Anderson lives out on the east end of Long Island, the CEO of Union Carbide. At this point, what is the status of his case? Vijay, are you still with us? Okay, then let me just put that question to Jack Doyle, author of Trespass Against Us. Jack Doyle, what is the status of the former CEO of Union Carbide, Warren Anderson's case at this point?
I'm not certain on the case there. I believe there's still outstanding issues in that case, but I'm not absolutely expert on the Warren Anderson situation at the moment, but I believe there's still some outstanding question about that case.
Ultimately, the subtitle Dow Chemical and the Toxic Century, what do you conclude about Dow Chemical?
Well, I think today we have to be concerned, all of us have to be concerned about the enormity of the synthetic chemical burden that's out there today. We have tens of thousands of chemicals that are in use in commerce daily, and many of these substances have never had real final toxicological profiles. In other words, I mean, there's a vast chemical experiment going on, and what we've tried to do with this book is raise the visibility of invisible trespass that our bodies, our biology, mothers nursing children today are passing dioxin onto their children, for example, and other substances that have become products of the synthetic chemical revolution. We have all of this material that's woven into a global economy today, and it's now invading our biology and our ecology everywhere, and we have to really have to make a change in terms of how this material makes its way into commerce, and we have to have a better toxicological screening before these things get released into the world, because we're finding, I mean, if you look at Dow as one example, and certainly Dow is not alone in this group of companies who have brought these products, you see 10, 20, 30, 40 years of fighting going on to keep a product on the market that shouldn't have been on the market in the first place. In this book, there are some case histories of 2,4-5-T, a herbicide that's been used for that was in use for over 40 years before it was removed from the market.
Jack Doyle, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. Author of Trespass Against Us, Dow Chemical, and the Toxic Century. And that does it for today's program on this 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster, one of the worst industrial accidents in the history of the century. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I'll see people in Austin for the anniversary of Texas Observer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.